This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with Dr. Bill Venuti. We'll hear how that doctorate came about for a guy who had never even heard of college, he says, before joining the Navy as a teenager in World War II. He served on the battleship USS North Carolina, which you can go see for yourself. It's a museum ship in Wilmington, North Carolina. Later, we're going to hear how often Bill makes it out there from his home in Los Gatos, California. But for now, let's go back to his time aboard World War II's most decorated battleship, which participated in every major naval operation of the war in the Pacific. He was a lookout on the North Carolina for five major battles in 1943 and 44, shelling all those islands you've heard of in the Gilberts, the Marshalls, the Marianas, and more.
When the Japanese planes would come in, their mode of operation would be to, they knew we were going to come in and bombard the islands. They had knowledge of the 102 ships in the area. They would send from different places where they had their airports, mostly about 80 of the, they call them Betty bombers, either bombers or torpedoes and bombs. Anyway, they would send them in before the bombardment, the night before the bombardment, but before it got dark. They didn't want to come in during daylight because they'd been shot down pretty easily. So they waited until it got dark. So, of course, we were taking our zigzag pattern. And what they do with their 80 planes or whatever number there were, they would circle around where the ships were. Of course, we had like 120 planes for each of the eight carriers. But we can't send them up because the planes would come back in the dark, and it's very difficult to land a plane in the dark on a carrier. So all we did, we had to wait for them to come in. So we'd have a zigzag pattern. And then when it was completely dark, when we could not see them from below, they'd send their planes in and do their bombarding and drop the torpedoes. They would also drop flares, and the flares were on parachutes. And so the lights from the flares, you could see all the ships, not like daylight, but you could see the outline of the ships, and they could see too. So they knew which ships to attack and where to drop the torpedoes. So my job was to indicate where the planes were coming from, how many there were, and so on. That's my job, was to look out.
Yeah, so you're passing on that information so your ship and others can use their anti-aircraft guns to try to shoot down these Japanese planes. That just, for a teenager, that sounds like a lot of responsibility. You've got a lot of lives at stake based on how quickly and accurately you perceive and pass on that information.
That's true. Of course, our ship had 16-inch guns, real big. They had a range of like 25 miles, and these were used to bombard the islands. It would be about 10 or 15,000 yards offshore when we did the bombarding. But also, we had anti-aircraft. We had 20-millimeter guns, 40-millimeter guns, and so on, the 5-inch guns. And so the 5-inch guns and the 20-millimeter and 40-millimeter would be used to shoot down the planes. We would try to shoot down as many planes as possible. Of course, sometimes we didn't know when they were coming in, that be above the flares, they would come in below the flares. Then we could see them and start to fire at them. And, of course, they would try to hit, once they knew they were going to fall in the water after they were shot down, they tried to hit a ship. And on several occasions, they tried to hit our ship. So I remember one where forward, right side of the ship, a plane tried to crash into our ship. And we were moving along, and it just landed in the water, and we were going by it, and the pilot was coming out, and the gunners, we just let him have it. He was going to die anyway, but they're screaming and yelling at the same time they're doing it. So that was interesting to see.
And you're watching all of this unfold. You had a view that very few people in the war ever had. What was that like? Was that exciting? Was that frightening? Did you get an adrenaline rush? What did that feel like to be up there seeing that expansive view of what was happening?
Of course, this is a long time ago, but I can recall that I was frightened the first time and the second time. But then there are so many times that these planes came in that one gets used to it. So you just think of doing your duty and observing where the bombs were landing, where the planes were. So that's what you're thinking about rather than your own safety. So I remember the first time I thought, well, I could be killed. And but then you don't think about it afterwards. Just do your duty and hope for the best. And luckily our ship was not hit all the time I was on it.
Yeah, your ship, for being the most decorated battleship, survived impressively well. If you look back and you think about the five battles that you were involved in, or maybe even some of the weather you encountered, or the different hazards that you faced or potentially could face, what do you look back on and say, you know, that was probably the closest call?
The fact that there were as many as 80 bombers in the area trying to sink our ships or land on the ships if they were shot down, I always thought that was a possibility. But once one becomes involved in their duty in spotting planes and where the bombs were landing, you don't think about that, about being hit or killed. You just do your duty and carry through.
Well, and you know, most things in life, there's a little bit of margin for error. But it strikes me that you didn't have much margin for error here. You make one mistake or you miss one plane or one threat, and it could cost people their lives.
Yeah, that is true. So, but one doesn't think about that. Just think of doing your duty and doing your best. Of course, I was the only one. There were three others in my battle station. We also had a lookout battle station in the back part of the ship where there were two or three guys too. So we all did the same thing at that time.
Well, that was another question I thought of is, what was it like with the other guys on that ship? What kind of rapport or camaraderie did you build?
Of course, they were also in lookout division, so I knew them personally. So you have friendship with them, but normally we did not communicate with each other during the battle. We just indicate what we saw. We had one officer who was in charge, and we report what we saw to him, and we convey that information down to the bridge.
Did you ever hear from home while you were out there?
We would get mail periodically. The mail would come in with another kind of ship, and they would transport the mail and also food and supplies and so on from one ship to another. But included would be the mail. That would occur only when we're probably in port. So that happened very often. And so after a battle, we would sometimes, depending upon the battle, go into one of the islands where we could anchor and get supply with oil or food and mail and so forth. So sometimes we would anchor when we would come in, and the cargo ship would anchor next to us, and they would send one of these devices across and transfer all the supplies that way. Sometimes it would be while we're underway, too. That's a lot more difficult, where the cargo ship would be underway next to our ship, and they would throw what they call a monkey's fist, a heavy weight with rope around it, and throw it to the other ship, maybe 40, 50, 60 feet, something like that. That would be a light line, then it would be a heavier line, then a heavier line, until it was heavy enough that you could tie the two ships together, and you would sail at the same time together. And of course, I would always see that too, so it was fun. Then, of course, there were times where we were not a battle, so we had workstations where my scrape paint, peeling paint, the decks were made of hardwood, and we would have to, what they call holy stone the decks. One of my workstations would have water hose and water down the deck, and then the holy stone was just like a normal brick with a hole in it, and you have a handle you put in the hole, and you would rub the deck when it's water to clean out the dirt and debris and so on. So that's one of my workstations.
Yeah, that sounds like a fun job. What would you say was the most difficult or challenging aspect of your duty?
Most challenging, making sure that I had the right information that I reported a bomb landing on the island and where it landed, and where the planes were too, when I would indicate that, or where the torpedo works were. Those were challenging, you know.
And I imagine you were thinking you'd probably stay on the North Carolina till this thing was over, till the Allies won, but that's not what happened.
I assume that would be the case, yes. I was prepared to do that until the end of the war. I liked to do what I had because it was fairly easy, and being able to see all the activity from sky control was very interesting. But I had no idea that I would be on a ship only 6 or 7 months. As I mentioned, they needed more officers from the others who were not in the Navy, and they were running out of civilians. So they delved into the enlisted ranks. Now it's just a seaman first class. There were 2,300 on the ship, 2,300 enlisted, and 120 officers, and a handful, like 5 or 6 Marine officers also. So they gave us an opportunity to take an examination to determine our qualifications for officer training. So of 2,300, 120 seamen applied for officer training. I did that. So then they took a second examination. They narrowed down to 60 and then 30, then 15. So only 15 of those who applied went back to officer training. But my objective was not to get a commission, but just to get back home. At that time, I had no intention of going to college. My parents were uneducated. My father was illiterate. So college was not a part of our family conversation at all. The main objective was to get a high school the plumber. So anyway, on the ship, my objective was just to get back home for a while. I was fortunate. I did pretty well, and the captain of the ship interviewed each one of us. That was an honor to be interviewed by the captain. So, but my objective was to get back to Philadelphia more than anything else. So I didn't know much about where universities were. I always wanted to go to Texas somehow. And so didn't know whether University of Texas or not. So that was one of my choices. But I knew about the University of Pennsylvania and Temple University in Philadelphia. So I selected those three. And lo and behold, they sent me back to University of Pennsylvania.
So I want people to hear what you said there, that you never had any thoughts of college, that wasn't really even a possibility in your family. But here, instead of spending the rest of the war out at sea, you get sent back to the States, to your hometown, to attend an Ivy League school and study on the Navy's dime. That's a pretty good deal.
How fortunate can one be? And I had no intention of ever going to college. And so while I was there, of course, I was in the V-12 program, then was ROTC program. At first, they were going to make us officers after only 90 days of college. But then the demand wasn't there anymore, so they extended it to 3 years. At that time, one could get a degree in 3 years. Of course, they had a semester during the summer months. So in 3 years, I was able to get my degree and my commission at the same time. So I was pretty busy. So I wasn't a very good student. I wasn't even prepared. My high school grades weren't very good. Not that I couldn't have done better, but it wasn't too important to me. So, and I was in the, you know, you divide the graduating class into two quintiles every 20%, and I was in the third quintile from the top. So anyway, I could have done better, but I never intended to go to college. I don't think I knew what a college or university was. Wow. Of course, that's not a subject of conversation where your parents are immigrants. They said they went to second or third grade. That's all they had. My father was illiterate. He couldn't write anything except his name, so. Mm-hmm. And Italian, too, so.
Well, and people are going to be surprised a little bit to hear where your story ends up in terms of academics and universities. But let's continue with where you were. So you're at the University of Pennsylvania. The war's still going on. Did you ever miss your buddies on the North Carolina?
I kept thinking about them, and several were from Philadelphia area. So when the war was over, they came back. I did maintain contact with them. So there are a few of them, but not very many.
And what did that mean to you when the war was over, when you heard that Japan had surrendered? How much satisfaction did that bring?
Okay, I was a student at the university at the time, in my last year, I believe. It meant that I had an opportunity to just continue with my college education or working and doing whatever. And I thought that I participated and made a small contribution toward the victory that we had. It was an interesting time to know that the war was over. Of course, we didn't know when the war would end, but it ended before we thought it would, thank goodness.
Yeah, I guess if it had continued, and if there would have been a need to invade mainland Japan, perhaps you would have been heading back over as a newly commissioned officer?
Very likely, right. But when I got my degree, got my commission at the same time. And at the time, they encouraged me to stay in the Navy. I had a choice of just not continuing in the Navy and just become a civilian, which I did. And the information I had is that if I stayed in the Navy and was promoted to higher ranks during my period of time in the Navy, it would be very difficult to get promoted because my commission was from the ROTC, and I would be competing against those who received a commission at Annapolis. And the people from Annapolis were favored. So understanding that, I decided not to continue in the Navy. So I just resigned my commission and started working. I stayed in reserves where I could go to a meeting for 3 hours once a month and during the summer for 2 weeks be on active duty. And so I did that for about 12 years and I was promoted to full lieutenant at that time. But as a civilian all the time, my first job out of college was as a junior level engineer in Philadelphia. Worked for a year there and learned a little more about engineering, although my degree was in mathematics, not engineering. And so I gave engineering some consideration, and I read where there were opportunities to work for the Bureau of Reclamation as an engineering trainee in Denver. So I took the examination, did okay, went to Denver. That's how my graduate education began. So I was in Denver and worked for them for a year. But nighttime, I took night courses in Denver at the University of Colorado. Went back to the campus for another year and was able to get my degree in civil engineering. And then at that time, I got married too. So.
And that's quite a story in itself, which we'll hear about when we come back. Plus, how a guy who had never heard of college became an engineering professor at San Jose State for more than 40 years. Plus, his experience with Honor Flight Bay Area, and even a quick word from one of his sons, himself a Silicon Valley success story. Hometown Heroes will come right back after this.